Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone with the third part of our year in review, the coverage that focused on unresolved systemic challenges to the American project, how everything is reverberating. In April, I spoke with Ed Young, science writer at The Atlantic, about our current not figurative plague, the third leading cause of death in the U.S.
January and February of 2022 were the fourth and fifth deadliest months of the pandemic to date. For about 6 months straight, the U.S. lost over 1,000 citizens every day. Where was the reaction that that level of death should have provoked? It feels like COVID has become similar to a lot of other causes of mass mortality in the US. Gun violence is a classic example that people just accept as part of the background of our lives.
Some of this has to do with fatalism, but you write that in the case of COVID, fatalism has been stoked by failure.
Yes. The U.S. went into this pandemic rated as the most prepared country for a pandemic in the world. Yet, across 2+ years and 2 separate administrations, it really did fail to control the pandemic. You know, before vaccinations, after vaccinations, that creates this sense of almost nihilistic abandonment, this feeling that you're going to get infected, we're just going to have to learn to live with it.
CDC data suggests that about 70% of the adult population in the U.S. are estimated to have had COVID, and around 68% are fully vaccinated. But far fewer Americans have gotten their boosters, in part, some say, because of fatigue over the question, are we immune yet? In May, we asked Catherine J. Wu, staff writer at The Atlantic and microbiology expert, that very question.
Clearly, the virus is slinging variants and subvariants at us at an incredibly fast pace. We get flu shots once a year, and that is the most frequent regular booster type of vaccine that we get. The pace at which we have been giving out COVID vaccines has, you know, been a couple times a year, at least, depending on who you are. That's not a pace we can sustain. But if we know that they're not doing an extraordinary job at preventing infection, that they're not perfect, that's not an indictment of them. It's an invitation to think, what else can we do?
That's another question that reverberates. Along with its corollary, why didn't we do more? As of 2020, for the very first time, gun violence overtook car accidents. It also became the leading cause of death in children. Recent data show an uptick of 30% between 2019 and 2020, including death by suicide, by accident, and by homicide, with homicides outpacing the other two categories. And it was a horrific year for mass shootings. A supermarket in Buffalo, New York, an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas, a medical building in Tulsa, Oklahoma, a 4th of July parade in Highland Park, Illinois, a nightclub in Colorado Springs, a Walmart in Chesapeake, Virginia, a string of tragedies that reverberate. CNN's Victor Blackwell.
Listen, I was counting in the car talking with my producer. I've done 15 of these. And we keep having the conversation about Democrats will say guns, Republicans will say mental health, and nothing will change. And I'll probably do another one this year. Family after family, having nowhere to go with their grief. We'll get into a political conversation later, but is this the way we're supposed to live? Are we destined to just keep doing this? City after city? Have we just resigned that this is what we are going to be?
After the Uvalde shooter killed 19 children, we took up the issue of using visual documentation to report on violent death with journalism professor Susie Linfield.
You can say torture, you can say concentration camps, you can say gun violence, But these words are somewhat anodyne, at least at a certain point. And one of the things that I think that photographs can do is make realer to us what the actual experience of violence, of degradation, of suffering is.
You suggest that the whole world had that experience when they saw pictures of the Holocaust or of the liberation of those camps.
Well, yes and no. That's actually an interesting example. You should never assume that everyone has the same reaction to a photograph.
Hmm.
Photographs are very, very slippery things. Most of the photographs of the Holocaust, certainly most of the iconic ones we know, were taken by Nazis celebrating their atrocities. But at the end of the war, German civilians were forced to see photographs of the camps and to actually view the piles of corpses that were still in the camps. Their reaction was not what the Allies had hoped. Their reaction more often was a kind of resentment. Why were they being forced? You know, they didn't have anything to do with this. The Allies were hoping that this would inspire a kind of moral reckoning among German civilians. But we know that that reckoning really didn't happen until the 60s. It was the children of the perpetrators who began that reckoning.
That is fascinating. The generational difference, this kind of reckoning, which you describe as an Emmett Till moment. He was a teenaged victim of lynching in the 50s. His mother insisted that photos of his body be shared. And the image was used in a lot of protests. It didn't launch the protest, but the picture enabled his story to be told, which educated many ignorant people about the horror of lynchings in the U.S. But you also note there's a big danger in overstating the political power of any photograph.
Yeah, and I think lynching is another very interesting example.
Right. They took pictures on the day, souvenirs.
They were actually postcards that white people in the South would apparently send to relatives, friends, whomever. So that's actually a very good example, sort of like the Holocaust photographs, that what might fill one person with absolute horror is not interpreted by other people in the same way.
This year, we also discussed some of the nuances of modern prejudices that don't gain headlines. In July, we asked Sabrina Strings, an associate professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine, about her work examining the deep connection between race and our culture's abhorrence of fat, an attitude that dates back to the Renaissance, bound up with Christianity and moral purity.
When I first started doing the research into this, putting your little simple search terms, coming back were a lot of references to Irish women. And I thought, I don't know what's going on here because I'm looking for representations of race and blackness and whiteness and body size. And I keep getting Irish women. What is happening? So it took me a while to understand that the category of whiteness is always shifting. This is still true. And that's important because what it means is that whiteness is always aspirational. If it were settled, then we would know who belongs where at all times, and we might also have the ability to protest such standards. But if there's always the possibility of another group entering the coveted space of whiteness, people are less likely to protest it. And so this is one of the things that was happening with Irish people in the United States. When they arrived, there was this fear that they were overly fat, which is interesting given the context of their arrival, right? Here they're fleeing famine. But the moment they arrive in the U.S., they're too fat, right? So this makes no sense at all.
Why do you think we're always preaching fat or thin? I mean, even with the blatant racism aside, why is weight something we love to proscribe, prescribe? Why?
If we look at earlier moments or even different regions of the world, you can find that people have different body size preferences. But what made the contemporary shift to the slender ideal different was that it was placed within a hierarchy of humanity. Were it not for that, perhaps other individuals would have been able to say, you know what, I find different body sizes more attractive. And so I don't agree with this rendering. There could have been a greater conversation that could have shifted the aesthetic ideal or moved the needle. But there was this economic imperative, there was a racial imperative, there was a religious imperative, and then later there was a medical imperative for people to be slender.
And even that last imperative, which appears the most empirical of the bunch, has plenty of problems. Nevertheless, we persist in trying to create hierarchies of humanity, even amongst groups fighting to be seen as equal. In November, in the midst of stories about Black celebrities posing anti-Semitic content, I spoke with Leo Ferguson, director of strategic projects of the Jews for Racial and Economic Justice. And to summarize, he suggested that Black people who are anti-Semitic and the Jewish people who obsess especially on Black people's anti-Semitism have each absorbed the prejudices established as norms by white supremacist Christians long, long ago. But I pressed the issue. Wasn't there something particular about the tension between Blacks and Jews?
Yeah, great question. So crib notes for the particularity would be James Baldwin's writing about anti-Semitism and about the conflict between non-Jewish Black people and white Jews. I think that's probably a great place to start. The piece I'm referring to is Negroes are anti-Semitic because they're anti-white.
I have it.
Yeah.
He wrote in the New York Times in 1967.
Yeah.
The grocer was a Jew, and being in debt to him was very much like being in debt to the company store. The butcher was a Jew. And yeah, we certainly paid more for bad cuts of meat than other New York citizens. You know, he goes on to say the army may or may not have been controlled by Jews. I don't know. And I don't care. I know that when I worked for the army, I hated all of my bosses because of the way they treated me. I don't know if Nabisco's Jewish, but I didn't like clearing their basement. I don't know if Rikers is Jewish. I didn't like scrubbing their floors. The root of anti-Semitism among Negroes is, ironically, the relationship of colored people all over the globe to the Christian world.
He's talking about white supremacy. He's doing a really interesting trick, which is that he is, I think maybe to get under the skin of Jews, certainly to be thought-provoking, he is essentially describing Jewish assimilation into Christendom rather than Jewish assimilation into whiteness.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's because he was aware of Jewish people of color or the global Jewish diaspora, or if it's because he was thinking very specifically of, as he calls it, the vices of white Christianity in the United States, the enabling of anti-Black racism, of enslavement, of Jim Crow, of lynching, of every terrible thing that's been done to Black people on this land. So much of that has been enabled by Christianity and excused by Christianity. And when Jews emigrated to this country in large numbers for the first time at the turn of the 20th century, they began a process that I think we often think about in racial terms, in terms of assimilating into whiteness. What Baldwin is naming here is that it also looks like, in many ways, assimilation into a pre-existing religious and cultural hierarchy, which Jews have benefited from enormously, right? The white parts of my family are part of that story of upward mobility coming from a deeply unsettled, unsafe homeland in the old country and coming here and eventually finding a kind of stability in the United States. But in part, that was by virtue of whiteness.
I'm just wondering, since Jews are considered both a religious group or an ethnic one, or both, when we talk about anti-Semitism right now, is that steeped in the religion or in race?
I think that what we're seeing is much more about culture and a general sense of the other. The Jew is the other, the outsider, the interloper. This has a long history in anti-Semitic ideology, going back to both fears around immigration and cultural change, the kinds of things that people have said about Jews for hundreds of years. Certainly in the 20th century, the idea of Jews as communists, as people who were going to come in and undermine society, but also the flip side of that, the idea of Jews as the masterminds controlling everything.
You said that the difference in this moment is that the thoughts and arguments of right-wing chat rooms have made it to the mainstream. There's always an argument centered around normalization, whether or not seeing this ugly side reflected everywhere publicly is ultimately a good thing or a terrible thing?
Well, it's always better to be out in the sunlight than in the darkness.
You sure about that?
It's better to be real with who we are as a country so that we can find real solutions.
The alternative seems to be perpetual reverberation. That's the message I got at the start of 2022 from David M. Perry and Matthew Gabriel, authors of The Bright Ages, A New History of Medieval Europe, who emphasized the importance of understanding that the Dark Ages had sunshine of their own.
Matt usually says, but I'm going to steal it from him, they lived in color. They did not live in a black and white world. And in some cases, the colors on the stones have faded. And in other cases, we just somehow don't look at the colors that are left.
I'm curious, though, if we really did understand the period as you do, what do we stand to gain?
Although there's a limited number of things we can do sometimes in our society, we still do have choice. You know, political budget is a certain number of dollars. We can put it on X or we can put it on Y. You know, we've made a choice. That's not a foreordained conclusion. So if we're talking about like this idea of the clash of civilizations, if we focus on the reason that people chose violence in certain cases, but chose understanding or respect in other cases, those can be models for how we relate to interreligious tradition relationships for the future. When people are telling you that the past is very simple, that you can draw a straight line from X until Y in the modern day, they're selling something. And we have to ask, what are they selling and why are they selling it? And what if we look at it from a different perspective? Does that upend the entire story that they're trying to tell and the entire product that they're trying to peddle?
So 2022 was a year. We could spend more time less scared outdoors. Some of us set plans hatched during the lockdown in motion, but it wasn't great. I will say, in a year that felt breathless, we did learn a great deal about where we are and where we're from, more than usual. And for those of us who need them and who doesn't, there were hints that we're not altogether powerless. It's just really hard. But what's the alternative? Perpetual reverberation? That's a phrase I hope to inter with these sacred bones of 2022. Happy New Year, dear listeners. On the Media is produced by Michael Owinger, Eloise Blondio, Molly Schwartz, Rebecca Clark Callender, Candace Wong, Suzanne Gaver, with help from Tammy George. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Nerviano and Sam Baer. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.